This week marks the 100th anniversary of the conclusion of the State of Tennessee versus John Thomas Scopes trial. In keeping the faith, God, democracy, and the trial that riveted a nation, acclaimed historian Brenda Wineapple revisits the Scopes monkey trial of 1925, not just as a courtroom clash over evolution, but as a defining moment in the struggle between religious belief, scientific inquiry, and democratic ideals in America. Wineapple brings to life the characters at the center of the drama, Clarence Darrow, William Jennings Bryan, and John Scopes, while exploring the broader cultural fault lines of the trial exposed. It is a reflection on faith, freedom, and the American experiment. Brenda Wineapple is the award-winning author of The Impeachers. The new book is Keeping the Faith, and it's a pleasure to welcome Brenda Wineapple to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
As we look to the anniversary, and we're in the anniversary of this event, what do you think that has been lost through time in our knowledge of the Scopes trial?
Well, it's a very good question. I think what happens often, things that get lost, is that it's very hard for us to imagine what it was like at another period of time because we don't see all the connections. Today, if we read the newspaper and there's one article about immigration and another article about food, whatever it happens to be, we already know the connection between these disparate topics. But when we have the Scopes trial, something like the Scopes trial, we just think of one event and we, you know, it's come down to us as the monkey trial. H.L. Mencken gave it that name. It sounds kind of silly. Why were people talking about evolution 75 years after Darwin? What's going on? It was kind of spectacle and a circus that happened in a small town in Tennessee. And so it's one of those events in American history that's peculiar and often belittled. And I think what we lose in that particular case is the fact that in many ways, the Scopes trial was a kind of proxy trial. And there were other issues that were going on at the time that fed into, for want of a better term, for the subtext of the trial.
So let's talk about where this all begins. So you bring us to Dayton, Tennessee, 100 years ago, and John Scopes is a high school teacher accused of violating the state's Butler Act. We'll get to that in a second, which prohibited teaching evolution in public schools. How long had that been brewing and percolating before it led to an actual trial?
Well, it hadn't been brewing and percolating in Tennessee that long because the act was passed in March and the trial takes place in July. So as soon as the act, the Butler Act, was passed, prohibiting the teaching of evolution in the schools, because theoretically it was supposed to conflict with the divine creation as is argued in the, or is said in the Bible, as soon as that happened, the ACLU, which was a fairly new organization, American Civil Liberties Union, put an ad in a couple of Tennessee papers saying that if anyone would volunteer to break that law, they would defend the person. And so John Scopes, people in town asked John Scopes to break the law. And he said, of course, I've already broken it. You can't teach biology without teaching evolution. And when a group of fundamentalist Christians who read the Bible very literally got wind of this, they sent William Jennings Bryan, three times presidential candidate on the Democratic ticket, to Dayton to prosecute Scopes. And on the other side, there was a very famous attorney, Clarence Darrow, who, when he heard that Bryan was going to prosecute Scopes, he too went to Dayton. So these powerhouses, these major figures, rock stars, went to Dayton, and that's how the trial became such a cause célèbre at that time. And as I said, it's only a few months after the Butler Law passed. But the issues that were implied by the trial had been around before and certainly after World War I, as we're in the period of the 1920s, and there's a lot of there's a lot going on. We think of the 20s as the jazz age. It was pretty
Right.
jazzy in many ways.
And it becomes a circus pretty quick, right? I mean, the whole trial becomes a very circus-like atmosphere as it begins. And because of the reasons you just mentioned of having these powerhouses and an issue that has been talked about and discussed for some time.
Well, I think the media made it into a circus. You know, it was a media circus, sells newspapers. And of course, social media at the time was the radio. Radio was new and the trial was broadcast. So that's a very important aspect of the trial. But despite the circus element of the trial, 200 journalists coming to town, hot dog stands, lemonade stands, selling ice cream in the middle of the summer, of course. Besides that, the issues were very important and they were very real, which is, in a sense, why these powerhouses took up the case.
You mentioned Clarence Darrow and talked about him being famous. He had controversy going into this case, though, didn't he?
Yeah, he was very controversial. I can't be that famous without being controversial. He had just the year before, he had defended two teenagers who committed a grotesque murder and were proud of it. They killed a third teenager just for the hell of it. And he defended them not because he thought they were innocent. They weren't. They admitted they were guilty, but because he so hated capital punishment. And he'd been a longtime labor lawyer. He took on the case of anarchists. He was known as the attorney for the damned, so people that the status quo damned he would take up. And he himself, of course, was slightly controversial, you might say, because he had been indicted twice for bribing a juror. So there was an aura about him, but he was a wonderful and unusual trial defense lawyer.
When you look at this for you, did the fact that this had so many connections to where we are now play into why you wanted to inspect it in such a close and careful way?
Well, it's an interesting question, Joe. Actually, when I started the book, I could never have imagined 2025 in the way that 2025 has come to pass. Of course, I live in the world and I can't close out what's going on. But during the time that it took to research and write the book, a lot of what was very relevant today was not as obvious. But there are threads through American history, political history, cultural history, because really this is a cultural phenomenon that you can see reflected in the trial that have been with us and continue to be with us, whether the questions are fanaticism, whether the questions are censorship, whether the question is the assaults on the First Amendment, whether
Right.
the question is race, all of those things, very much part of the country in which we live and have lived.
So in just what you just said, this case in your eye comes down less to do with science and scientific theories and law and more about politics and political theater.
Well, it has to do with all of them wrapped up together. I mean, in a sense, science, of course, becomes the cause of the trial. Seemingly, people get science confused with technology, and certainly science and technology seemed responsible for some of the horrors of World War One, like poison gas. But it's also true that the theory of evolution got mixed up in people's minds with social Darwinism, which is a very different thing, has nothing to do with Darwin. And it seemed to me when I began this book that people didn't really even understand evolution. So the question was, why are they fighting about it? In terms of religion, again, it was only one aspect of a certain religion that was being fought for. Now, Brian thought he was doing a duel to the death on behalf of Christianity, but his view of Christianity and a kind of Christianity was narrow. It was a literalist view of the Bible. And many liberal Protestant clergy were appalled by the stand that Ryan took. And in fact, on the other side, many of the scientists come to testify were themselves not only Christians, they taught Sunday school. So you see that there was a kind of overlap between the two, and that makes you wonder, well, what then is really being, what is really being talked about? And the scientists weren't even allowed to testify. So it wasn't about science and people wanting to know, oh, what is the science here? Shall we stand against it? Become something else. What, who controls the classroom is partly what we're talking about. And that's very pertinent and has been for a long time. It's certainly pertinent now.
Brenda Wineapple is the author of Keeping the Faith, God, Democracy, and the Trial That Riveted a Nation. At a time, I was just struck by something that you said a moment ago about how much people understood as to really what was going on and the context of it. And for as deeply as it was reported and as much as it was reported, was there a good job being done of explaining that context?
I think there was actually. And again, I think that's something that we've lost. I mean, don't forget, there were local papers, there were national papers, there were editions, you know, morning, noon, and night. We can't imagine a newspaper world quite like this, the one that existed in the 1920s. And there was, of course, as there is today, there was a range of responses. But I think there were quite a number of responsible journalists, as there always are, that really understood, and even cartoonists, I've seen a lot of the cartoons from this particular time, who understood what the larger context was, and you know what was being discussed. Because, as I said earlier, it was very much part of the fabric of what was going on, the air people breathed, the kinds of things that they were concerned about, what we call today pocketbook issues, changes in the culture. Things that seemed to be going too fast, people that seemed, you know, people wanted to have control over their lives, and they felt that was being taken away from them.
As the decision comes down on July 21st, 1925, obviously the ripples, the ramifications, both immediate and for decades after, remain. And I guess that is an interesting part of the story too, of how relevant not only today the story is, but as it has been throughout our history over the last 100 years.
Yes, I would completely agree with that. And we see these, for want of a better word, eruptions. I think that the issues are always there, but sometimes they reveal themselves in very different ways. And as I said earlier, today we can see that in questions about not just the First Amendment, but related issues about religion in the classroom, related issues about who controls what you read, think, who you love, even if you want to go that far. And well, I should say that one of the main questions really had to do with bigotry and intolerance and why it is, or can we, the question, can we be tolerant of other people's religions, points of view, people who don't have a religion, say, agnostic as Darrow was, and how shall or shall we, is it right to legislate what people think, feel, read, and want to do? And I think one of the things that's interesting too is at the time, 1925, the great historian W.E.B. Du Bois, black historian, was writing in his magazine, The Crisis, which he edited, that he said, the truth is, Dayton, Tennessee is America. What's going on there is a reflection of a larger of larger issues in the culture. It's not a confined small episode in a small town in the South.
And I guess this can be interpreted many different ways, but it all really ends up being a draw, doesn't it?
In a way, well, you know, Scopes did violate the law. He was guilty. I mean, he did. There is a law that says you shouldn't teach this, and he did. Of course, the irony is that the textbook contain that he taught from, the biology textbook, had evolution in it, but putting that aside, he did. The ACLU and the defense, Clarence Darrow, they wanted to get this case before the Supreme Court. And so they were able to get it before the step was to get it to the Tennessee Supreme Court, which they did, but then it was thrown out on a technicality. So, in a sense, the defense lost, but in a sense, they won because to the extent that we're talking about it and that people in 1925 talked about it, they were talking about the issues and they were having a conversation and they were having an argument and they were having a broadcast about the very issues that were implied by the trial. So in a sense, it was a draw, and but you could say there was something that they were able to transmit and convey then and now.
And just because he's found guilty, really overturned on a technicality, and never had to pay the money.
No, it was a $100 fine. That was the technicality. The jury was supposed to determine the fine, not the judge, over a certain amount. And actually, what happened to Scopes is interesting. He was an unpretentious young man. Many of the scientists involved and interested in the trial took up a collection so that he could take postgraduate courses at the University of Chicago. So that was very interesting. And no, I mean, actually, interestingly enough, too, the issue wasn't Scopes, because Brian himself, defense, figurehead for the prosecution and the literalist interpretation of the Bible, he volunteered to pay Scopes's fine. So again, that tells you that something else was going on. It was a larger, dramatic moment, really, and Scopes almost became incidental to it.
One of the things, and we'll end on this, is that certainly historians look at this and debate it. William Jennings Bryan died 5 days after the conclusion of the trial. Whether the two are connected, it's impossible to say, but certainly something that is looked at, and it's hard not to believe in some way that this was very stressful. A stressful case, and certainly a stressful case for Brian.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you think this is summertime, this is July, as hot as we may be here. If you're in the east, you're in the south, the west, southwest, and it was excruciatingly hot. There was no air conditioning. Brian was also diabetic. The stress, as you say, Joe, was enormous. I'm sure that all played a part in what happened to Brian. And of course, he put himself in a sense, but Darrow put him on the stand. He was presumably an expert on the Bible, so he was put on the stand, and that didn't go very well, and that couldn't have been easy either.
So on this 100th anniversary, what do you hope people learn and come out of the book knowing about this major trial, especially during the times we live in now?
Yeah, a couple of things. One is that it was a spectacle. All trials, in a sense, have that potential, but it was much more than that, as I said. And I would take, as I said earlier, the page from Du Bois. I mean, and I really think that the trial put certain aspects of democracy on trial, and I think that someone like Darrow summarized much of what was going on when he said, that today the public schools are under attack. Tomorrow it would be the private, the next day the preachers and the lecturers, and pretty soon we have to be careful about that because what's at issue here is intelligence, enlightenment, the willingness to take on ideas and allow other people to take on ideas. And as he concluded, he said, "You can only be free if I am free." And I think that we still wrestle with those issues and that question of freedom, the freedom to worship, think, go to school, what have you.
Brenda Wineapple is the author of Keeping the Faith, God, Democracy, and the Trial That Riveted a Nation. The book is published by Random House. Brenda, thank you so much for being with us. An absolute delight to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Be well. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Again, the name of the book is Keeping the Faith by Brenda Wineapple. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.